next case is Coble versus Commonwealth. Mr. Sachs and Ms. Barron, I think you're both on the line. You're old pros at this, but I'll go over the guidelines. You've got 15 minutes. And since we're doing this by teleconference, I'd ask you to pause periodically so that if the judges have a question, we can interject. Mr. Sachs, would you like to reserve any time for rebuttal?
Yes, I would say maybe 4 minutes.
4 minutes, okay. 4 minutes for rebuttal. Mr. Sachs, you can begin whenever you're ready.
Thank you very much. May it please the court, good afternoon. This is an appeal from the Chesapeake Circuit Court, a final order, November 19, 2014, finding the defendant guilty pursuant to earlier jury verdicts of third offense distribution of cocaine and third offense distribution of heroin, and imposing the jury's recommended 10-year, there was a 10-year sentence on each, the mandatory minimum, for a total sentence of 20 years. The single assignment of error, Your Honors, is that the trial court erred in admitting orders of the defendant's prior drug distribution convictions. There were two to make the predicate offenses to make these convictions at the jury trial third offenses on the grounds that those orders, those two prior orders, did not properly establish the prior predicate convictions. Now, the evidence does establish, as accepted by the jury, that the defendant sold a quantity of cocaine and heroin to a cooperating undercover purchaser in a hotel room. That's not an issue. But what is at issue is whether those acts would be sufficiently established as third offenses. He was the third offense enhanced penalty element was found by the jury, but it was based on two prior distribution convictions, both of which would be necessary. Either of these prior convictions should not have been admitted by the trial court, then the verdicts cannot stand. It's our position, respectfully, that both of these orders were insufficient as a matter of law, and the trial court abused its discretion in admitting those orders. The two prior convictions were both from the Portsmouth Circuit Court, one from June 21st, 2012, in which the defendant was convicted of possession with intent to distribute accommodation sale, and the second one was from October 22, also 2012, in which the order recited the title of the offense as possession with intent to distribute cocaine, but the statute of conviction was recited as Code Section 18.2-250, which is simple possession. Obviously, simple possession being insufficient as a matter of law to be a predicate offense.
This is Judge Russell. If we agree with you on one of the two convictions, what's the proper remedy? Is it a resentencing or is it a new trial?
Well, I would say it's at a minimum a new trial, because this is evidence that was admitted by the trial court that should not have been admitted. And ordinarily, my position would be that where evidence is admitted and it's harmful error, reversible, that the remedy is a new trial, not just a new sentence, but a new trial.
How would it have been harmful, given that if they have found him guilty of the incident offense, then they would have been entitled to see some of this information in sentencing anyway?
Well, because these particular orders, these were elements of the offense. I mean, they go more than just sentence. They go to the very, it's an element of this offense to establish that there were two prior convictions for possession with intent to distribute or distribution. So where an element of the offense, where evidence has been admitted that should not have been admitted, that in the absence of which an element of the offense would not be established, then I think at a minimum a new trial. Frankly, we've asked as an alternative that the court find that this was harmful error and that the evidence was insufficient and dismissed the charges, because I think that's also a valid remedy where the evidence, where it goes to an element and the charge wasn't proven.
But why isn't he guilty? Assuming that one of the convictions is invalid, why isn't he guilty of the lesser included offense? I mean, doesn't he have
He could have been. That wasn't submitted to the jury, and that wasn't a verdict that they could find. So I think it was sort of an all or nothing proposition in terms of sufficiency. But I would affirm, Your Honor, that, and again, as I say, at a minimum, it would have to be a new trial. I don't think that it could be cured by just a new sentence. It goes to the very heart of the sufficiency on the findings of the case. Now, with respect to the two orders, if I may address those briefly, the possession with intent to distribute accommodation sale, you have to look at the code section carefully, because the way it's designed by the legislature, we would urge that an accommodation sale is a different offense from a possession with intent to distribute unqualified, as I call it in my brief, conviction.
Mr. Sachs, would you concede that whether accommodation or for profit, unqualified as you call it, that either is a violation of 18.2-248?
That is true, but here's the way the language of the statute reads. Under subsection A says it shall be unlawful for any person to distribute or possess with intent to distribute a controlled substance. That's the overarching statement. But then it breaks it down into different offenses. Subsection C says, and this is important, any person who violates this section, 18.2-248, with respect to a controlled substance, shall upon conviction be imprisoned for not less than 5 nor more than 40 years. But as you go down, I'm sorry, did I interrupt you? I thought somebody was asking a question. As you go down in subsection C, it says, when a person is convicted of a third or subsequent offense under this subsection, and it is alleged in the indictment that he has been before convicted of two or more such offenses, then you have the enhanced penalty. So subsection C, which talks about third offense conviction, says when a person is convicted of a third or subsequent offense, not under this section, which is 18.2-248, but under this subsection, and this subsection refers to the unqualified possession with intent to distribute, there is a totally separate subsection, subsection D, which creates the offense of possession with intent to distribute accommodation sale. And that makes it a Class 5 felony. So it is, while, yes, Your Honor, the statute, ultimately, it is a violation of the same statute, but it is not a violation of the same subsection. And that subsection C limits the third or subsequent offense to a prior conviction under this subsection. And the prior conviction for the accommodation sale was not under this subsection, but under subsection D. So by its very language, the statute excludes from the third or subsequent offense consideration a prior accommodation conviction, because that is not a prior conviction or a third or subsequent conviction under that subsection. I don't know if that makes it clear what our position is on that particular one. And I would point out, too, interestingly enough, the order of conviction, which is found in 229 of the appendix, the order says that the defendant pleaded not guilty to the charge of possession with intent to distribute cocaine, but guilty to possession with intent to distribute accommodation sale. And I would submit that that further corroborates that we're dealing with two different offenses, two different subsections for purposes of the third offense a third or subsequent offense. And I would finally note on that, the Commonwealth cites no cases on this particular issue, so it may be a quick question of first impression. I think I have about a minute left. Am I correct, Your Honor?
Actually, counsel, actually, you have a little less than a minute as to your rebuttal time.
All right.
So you can stop now, and you'll have your whole rebuttal time left.
All right, or may I use a little more time and then eat into the rebuttal?
Absolutely.
Okay, let me do that then. So I want to address the second order briefly. The court from Circuit Court Order, October 22, 2012. This is the order which indicates that the defendant entered a plea of guilty possession with intent to distribute cocaine as charged in the indictment and gave an offense description as possession with intent to distribute cocaine, but then gave code section is 18-2-250, which is simple possession. We would urge that that order is obviously internally inconsistent and cannot be saved by the Scrivener's error. There is no independent documentation, no trial record, no transcript, nothing to indicate what, obviously there's a mistake, couldn't be guilty of both, but we don't know which one it is. We would be guessing.
Mr. Sachs?
Yes, Your Honor.
At the trial in front of Judge Arrington, was the only thing she had in front of her on the issue of what was right or wrong with the order, the four corners of the document?
Yes, sir. The four corners of the document. That's it. So the court in Overby v. Commonwealth, 271 Virginia 231, a 2006 case, states a court may not engage in conjecture or surmise in determining the offense for which a defendant was convicted. And that, Your Honors, I believe is what we're doing. We would have to guess. How can we pick which one is right when we have no other independent evidence to tell us? So for those reasons, Your Honor, we would respectfully urge that both orders are defective, did not establish a prior offense under the statute, should not have been admitted, and the defendant is entitled to a reversal and, if not an outright dismissal, certainly a new trial.
Thank you, counsel. Judge Felton or Judge Russell, either of you have any more questions for Mr. Sack?
I do not.
Not at this time.
Okay. Ms. Darren? All yours. Yes.
Thank you. Thank you, Your Honors. Good afternoon. May it please the court. Leah Darren for the Commonwealth in this matter. First, I would like to point out that the other, as we argued on brief, that the argument in this case has well exceeded the argument that was made to the trial court in this case, and the we would submit, first of all, that the court would look at pages 18 through 19 and then the court's ruling on the accommodation of conviction on page 21 for that is the entire record that the court that the court should be looking at, and that was the entire argument that was made to the trial judge with regard to the admissibility of both of these orders. And other counsel has well exceeded the arguments made to the trial court, and it would not be appropriate for this court to consider any argument that was not made in the trial court. So we have number one, the accommodation distribution offense, and really the only argument that was made with regard to that offense, it was made on page 19 of the record, and it had something to do with the fact that the accommodation defense is not a lesser-included offense of possession with intent to distribute cocaine. It's a sentencing issue. And counsel is indeed correct that it was a sentencing issue, but the language of 18-2-248C, and this argument certainly was not made. Excuse me, is somebody asking a question? Okay. This argument about the language of 248C somehow excluding accommodation as a predicate offense, it was simply not made in the trial court. And aside from that, if you look at the language of 248C, it refers to convictions under 18.2.248, and certainly the accommodation conviction was under 18.2.248. Subsection D simply allows the defendant a break on the sentence that's imposed with regard to an accommodation offense, and it reduces it the distribution offense is 5 to 40 years. The accommodation punishment range is a Class 5 felony, and that is 1 to 10 years. So, but clearly, I'm sorry, Your Honor?
Hello?
Yes, there's some background noise, and I can't tell whether someone's trying to stop me. So, I take it there is no question, so I'll continue. That would be our argument on the accommodation distribution conviction. With regard to the second conviction, we're looking at pages 18 through 19 of the argument on this of the appendix with regard to the argument on that, and the court described the error in the citation of the code section as a Scrivener's error. There was no argument by counsel at all with regard to the court's characterization of the error in the order as a Scrivener's error. And as we have argued on brief, the typing of an incorrect number is a classic example of a Scrivener's error.
Do we, looking at the order itself, if that is the only evidence before the trial court, which is the error? There is a typing error. Which is it?
That's correct. In the order, there is a typing error. If you look at page 232 of the appendix record, we have the offense description and crime code record number indicating possession with intent to distribute cocaine, and we have the citation of the code being 250. Now, if you look at page 234, which the Commonwealth also offered in support of the conviction of by way of clarifying exactly what the defendant was convicted of.
Can an indictment ever clarify what one is convicted of? I thought that was kind of the thrust of the Supreme Court's decision in Palmer. Plead lesser-included offenses or are convicted of lesser-included offenses all the time, the indictment can't explain if the order itself may indicate that a lesser-included offense was the issue.
Well, I think the point here is the court's characterization of this error as a Scrivener's error. And so the indictment indicates the same crime, the violation of 18.2.248, which is the proper code section. The conviction and sentencing order indicates pleading guilty to possession with intent to distribute cocaine as charged in the indictment. And then the only error that was alluded to at trial is simply the incorrect citation of the Virginia Code Section 18.2.250. There is no, so we submit that the evidence presented to the trial judge supports his ruling that this was, in fact, a Scrivener's error.
Okay.
And
Ms. Darren, you cite in brief 801-428B, which I think very well may have been applicable here. Why didn't the Commonwealth utilize that before presenting the order?
I can't speak to that, Your Honor. I simply can't speak to that. But I don't think that that invalidates the conviction simply because they didn't go back to Portsmouth and ask the Portsmouth court to change the clerical error in the order prior to presenting it in this case. The other cases that we have cited, we submit, support our position on the matter.
Ms. Barron, does the Virginia Crime Code number that's listed, VCCNAR3043F9, cite to the right PWID cocaine?
The pages 18 through 19 of the record indicate that it does. Yes.
What is that counsel's statement that it does, or does that record reflect that it actually does? I mean, how do we do that?
Well, I think that's counsel's unilateral avowal, which was not disputed by anyone and certainly accepted by the court. So we submit that further supports the court's decision in this case, but this is a mere Scrivener's error. We would also point out that there's no indication here that there was a surprise about this prior conviction or that there was any misleading by the citation of 18T250. So we would submit that the standard of review is abuse of discretion, that the classic case of a Scrivener's error is set out in Wellmore Cole, and which is adopts language from this court and Zhu. These cases are cited in our briefs, and that Scrivener's errors tend to occur singularly, and the classic case, the classic example, is the typing of an incorrect number. So the court's characterization of this incorrect number as a Scrivener's error is well supported by the case law as well as the record. There was no real argument with regard to that finding. There was no argument with regard to that finding as evidenced by the transcript at Appendix 18, 9, and 19. And we would ask that the court affirm the conviction.
Ms. Darren, did the Commonwealth bear the burden of establishing that the 18.2250 is a Scrivener's error beyond a reasonable doubt?
I don't believe so. I don't think that is the standard of review with regard to the admission of evidence.
Conviction beyond a reasonable doubt, didn't they?
Well, certainly, but I think the court's characterization that it certainly did, but that's not the standard for the admission of evidence.
But for it to have convicting effect, it has to rise to that level.
I believe that the court is piggybacking it would be inappropriate for the court to blend those two. This is an admissibility of evidence standard that we have here, and I'm looking at my brief here to see if I have some language about that, but I do think it would be inappropriate for the court to indicate that was a beyond a reasonable doubt standard.
So I guess the argument there is that they didn't challenge the sufficiency of the evidence, only its admissibility.
That's correct. Absolutely. That's correct. And then finally, Your Honor, I made a note with regard to a question that you asked other counsel that I wanted to address. And first of all, yes, there was no sufficiency argument made on appeal, so it would be inappropriate for the court to accept other counsel's invitation that dismissal would be appropriate in this case. We would say that we would agree with other counsel that But because this is an element of the offense, the defendant, there was a question in my mind as to whether the defendant would be entitled to just a resentencing or a new trial. And since this is an element of the offense, we would have to agree with other counsel that he would be entitled to a new trial, but certainly not dismissal. That's not appropriate in this case.
Thank you, Ms. Darren. Judge Felton, Judge Russell, any other questions?
I have none.
None for me.
Okay, thank you, Ms. Darren. And Mr. Sachs, you've got 4 minutes.
I don't think I need all of that. Thank you very much, Your Honors, for your time. Again, very briefly, just a couple of reply points. I think that the accommodation issue was more than adequately preserved. Counsel made an objection at page 18 of the appendix. He indicated the defense, he objected to that order and specifically stated the defendant entered a not guilty plea to PWID cocaine, but guilty to PWID accommodation. He obviously was attacking the adequacy of that prior conviction to support a predicate offense. So I don't think that argument is valid, that there's somehow that was waived or that we've exceeded the argument the counsel made. Secondly, in this case, I think Judge Russell has raised a very compelling point that it would be anomalous to say that the standard for finding a Scrivener's error is something less than beyond a reasonable doubt, and yet that is the standard to find the existence of the conviction by the jury, the prior conviction, in order to satisfy the predicate offense. So I think that is the standard. The court did need to find beyond a reasonable doubt. I don't think the court could do that. Quite frankly, I don't even know how the court could find by a preponderance. I think, and I respect the trial judge greatly, but in a sense, it was really just almost tossing a coin. I mean, on what evidentiary basis, could we say that this was a Scrivener's error? It was a toss-up. We don't know. There is an error.
Counsel.
Yes.
So, counsel, when you look at the record, aren't you allowed, wasn't the trial judge allowed, to look at the various documents that were in evidence to make a determination, a reasonable determination, as to which error it was?
Well, my understanding, that's true. Yes, and you're absolutely right on that, on the principle, no question. But as I understand it, the only documents in the record, there was the conviction order, and there was the conviction and sentencing order, and then there was the indictment and the conviction order.
Right. So that's three different documents, right?
Yes, but the conviction order and the conviction and sentencing order are almost identical, except the sentencing order contains the sentence. But the conviction order recites the same dichotomy, the same discrepancy as the conviction and sentencing order. You have a representation that the offense led to was PWID cocaine, but that the code section that was violated was 18.2-250. So I don't think that is going to help provide independent evidence. If you have the same problem with each order, they're internally inconsistent. So the only other document that's independent, if you will, is the indictment. And as Judge Russell pointed out, I think it's clear an indictment itself, that's merely an accusation. That can't provide evidence to support that it was a Scrivener's error. We don't know what the defendant actually pled guilty to. We just don't know, because we have two very powerful and totally different representations in the conviction order and the conviction and sentencing order. So while I, yes.
Mr. Sachs?
Yes, Your Honor.
If you would, could you respond to the Commonwealth's argument that because this is the only assigned error is admissibility and not sufficiency, that something less than beyond a reasonable doubt is necessary.
I don't think that changed it. The question would be, what is the burden of proof that the Commonwealth would have to carry in order to establish a Scrivener's error? And I think when you're dealing with a criminal offense and an element of the offense, it should be the same burden as is required to establish with the jury.
But I can introduce a piece of evidence that doesn't prove something beyond a reasonable doubt all the time, and that's not a beyond the reasonable doubt standard for the admissibility of that piece of evidence. Is that correct?
That's true, except that I think it depending on, for example, in the voir dire area, if there's any reasonable doubt about a juror's qualification, the standard is that juror must be stricken. So there are instances where, because of the centrality of the issue or the importance of the issue in due process, that the standard is higher to allow something to be done. And I think in this case, as you perhaps insinuated or indicated earlier, when it's dealing with an element of the offense, goes directly to that, I think that the burden should be identified.
Mr. Sachs, I let you go on because Judge Russell asked a few questions in a row, but your time has expired, so
yes, it has, and thank you very much.
And thank you both for your arguments today. The case will be submitted to the court, and the court will convene in conference immediately upon concluding this teleconference.
Thank you, Your Honor.